Well, our program tonight has to do with energy sappers. You've heard us talk about that before. Parasites, human parasites. And this is going to be a special program for me because our guest, Jonathan Zapp, is very well knowledgeable about my late aunt, Dr. Shafika Caregula. She was a parapsychologist and a darn good one, MD doctor, and he's done some work into some of her work. So we'll talk with Jonathan Zapp about that as well when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Jonathan Zapp graduated from Ursinus College with honors in philosophy and English, received his master's degree in English from NYU. He is an author, teacher, philosopher. He has written extensively on human evolution and contemporary mythology. He was recently featured in two DVDs, Prophecy and The End of Time, a dialogue between Jonathan and Mayan scholar John Major Jenkins about the nature of prophecy and the 2012 end date and looking toward the event horizon. Jonathan has an extensive background in Jungian psychology, paranormal research, and dream interpretation. For 27 years, he's been using the tools of the Jungian psychology to study popular culture, contemporary mythology, and dreams for evidence that we are getting signals from the collective unconsciousness about the nature of a quantum evolutionary event approaching the human species. Special guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Jonathan, welcome back. It's been too long, my friend. How are you?
Oh, I'm great, George. I'm grateful to be back on your show.
Oh, likewise, indeed. And next hour, you'll bring us a special guest for a little bit. I'm looking forward to that, as a matter of fact, in a half. It's not too long
right.
from now.
I'm looking forward to it as well.
Jonathan, what have you been doing lately since we last talked, which was well over a year ago?
Yeah, it was March 2005. I've been working away at a unique website. Maybe you got to take a look at it.
Sure
did. Oracle on there I've been working on for a quarter of a century and finally got that online and have gotten almost everything I've ever written and thought about on that one website, a lot of the images I've taken and other things. So that's been keeping me very busy for the last year or so.
Tell me about these mind parasites that you've been doing some research on. I love that phrase, by the way.
Well, and I didn't create the phrase. That came from British occult scholar Colin Wilson, who was once a guest on your show, I believe.
Sure. He's a good man.
It really is a phenomenon that relates to the energy sappers that your aunt, Dr. Caregula, looked at as well. But it extends into a wide variety of areas that affect a great deal of what's happening on this planet. And I think the context of what's going on is, I don't know about, well, I guess I do know what you've been feeling for the last couple of weeks, and a lot of people have been feeling is just an even more disturbed sense about the world and what's going on in the Middle East. And I think that ratcheted down just a notch when we had the ceasefire. Today's the first full day of that. But I think everybody senses that this is just a lull and that our species is in really serious trouble. And that it's time for sort of some tough love and for the species to face some uncomfortable truths that we just haven't faced before. And I think that, even in your individual life, when you find that you're banging your head against the wall with some problem that you just can't solve and,
sure.
and you keep at it and it keeps defeating you, just like the world has been trying to create world peace and trying to resolve the problems that just keep getting worse. Usually what that means is that there's some crucial piece of information that you need to solve the problem, but that you're missing. And I think the case I want to make tonight is an idea of what part of that piece of information might be that we're missing. You know, we've heard from some of the physicists on your show that 90% of the universe is dark matter, and they don't even know what it is. And Aldous Huxley once called the unconscious of the human psyche a dark continent. And so I think there may be things on that dark continent that are not recognized.
Now, Jonathan, do you see, though, a difference between mind parasites and energy sappers? Because, you know, my aunt, when she did her research years ago, I think she came to the conclusion that a lot of the energy sappers didn't know what they were doing. I think parasites do.
Well, absolutely. There is a range of different phenomena here, and I think what your aunt covered in her book Breakthrough to Creativity is she recognized, as a person with credentials in psychiatry, that once she opened the door to the paranormal and to the parapsychological, she realized that, wow, you know, this is something that changes the way we look at everything. It changes the way we look at human beings, and it changes the way we look at various forces that may affect human beings. So these are related phenomenon, but there is a difference, and there are sort of different species of parasites, you might say. And so in order to look at this, you know, we have to consider that it's the human psyche that is the source of war, that is the source of environmental destruction. It's the single factor that's behind all of these problems we face, except for the occasional errant asteroid or something like that. Otherwise, everything really at its ultimate source relates to human psychology. And one of the problems with understanding human psychology, and I think Dr. Carrigula was starting to realize this too, is that we aren't able to define what mind is. And not only are we not able to define what mind is, we're not able to define where it is. There are some people that came, especially after the 60s, when your aunt was writing, and Freudian psychology and other modalities were still pretty popular. There was a shift to behaviorism, and then the neurological materialists took over. And they still dominate the colleges and universities of this country. And they would have you believe that the mind, which they actually believe is an illusion and doesn't exist anyway, but to the extent that we have any thought process, it's the result of biochemical process in the brain. They call it an epiphenomenon or a secondary effect of this biochemical process. But no one has shown that the mind exists inside the walls of your skull. In fact, night after night on your show, we get powerful evidence that is not the case from near-death experiences, right. For example, that the mind seems to have a hyperspatial aspect, a non-local aspect. So since we don't know where the mind is, we don't know that we're alone in our minds. This is a presumption that kind of underlies the thinking in a lot of modern psychology, and yet it's never been proven, and there's no reason to believe that we're alone in our minds. We're not alone in our bodies. In our bodies, we have parasites. Every human being has them.
Well, I know that she was a staunch believer in extraterrestrial life. She was very close to a remote viewer, Ingo Swann.
Right.
But there were moments, Jonathan, in her life she was very frustrated about really not being able to pierce through the veil of this unconsciousness or the consciousness. Sometimes she felt like she was getting very close to it, especially with some of her subjects and clients that she was working with. And then other times she felt like she just couldn't get through it. And then, of course, all of it was thrown out the window in her very untimely death, which is still strange because there are some people that believe that she died in a car accident. We were always told that she died when some electrical appliance fell into her tub when she was taking a bath.
Well,
it's
kind of
very bizarre. It was a bizarre story.
Well, you know, Colin Wilson in his novel of ideas, The Mind Parasites, makes the case that when people are going to have a breakthrough or are producing some sort of breakthrough, he used Beethoven as an example, that would help to wake the collective up, that there would be forces that would come and try and sabotage what they were doing. And I can understand her frustration because she was coming from the sciences. And the science likes to sort of look at things under a bright light. It likes to be able to measure things and so forth. And I'm very sympathetic with that. I would like to be able to do that too. But there are some things that are sort of at the horizon line of human awareness. And in order to be able to look at them, we have to sort of look through a glass darkly. We have to be willing to accept that we cannot see these things with perfect clarity and objectivity, except in rare cases. But we still need to look, and we need to discern the forms that we can see, even if they're shadowy and flickering at times. And I think that's what your aunt was willing to do, and, you know, even more today than in the 1960s when she wrote that seminal book, Breakthrough to Creativity, forces would rise up to resist that. People in the sciences, but who are really not taking a scientific attitude, but the attitude that's called scientism, that will dismiss certain things as not possible without any scientific or rational basis to their dismissal.
Yeah, I mean, I have always wondered, and so has our family, if she was done in, because we never knew if she was getting close to one of these breakthroughs, as you point out, Jonathan. And it is true that when scientists seem to be getting close to something, when mainstream science doesn't want them to, something strange happens to them. You know, we've got these incredible cases of 80-some microbiologists who have died under very strange circumstances. We have the death of Dr. Eugene Malov, who was trying to find an alternative energy source. I mean, all these things just continue to happen just before these individuals break through. Like her book, Breakthrough to Creativity,
right.
Just before they're ready to do something on a grand scale or release some information, something happens to them. And I've gone beyond saying this is ironic, and I don't believe in coincidences. I think something happened to her. I think she was getting very close to something, and somebody, I don't know who, but somebody did her in.
Well, there's a variety of ways that kind of thing can work. There is a tendency in biological systems, and we're all part of a biological system. We're all part of a food chain, and there's a kind of homeostasis. There's this, like, dialed-in equilibrium, and the whole larger organism wants to maintain that food chain, wants to maintain that homeostasis. So if there's something there that's like a mutagen that's going to change the balance of power, the way things work, then there's an immunological response. And so these forces can sort of send out their white blood cells, and the white blood cells might be the appliance falling in the bathtub, some like strange freak accident. There are many different ways that this can be made to happen. And so there's this natural resistance. I mean, in many ways, that the story of Christ was like that. You have somebody that was trying to change everything, and you see the result. They're immediately attacked. So that when there's a breach in the inner eye, something will come in and try and seal it. You see that in the movie The Matrix. If somebody starts to wake up, and The Matrix is very much about this theme, and in parallels with the Gnostics had to say about the parasites, then forces come in, agents come in of whatever sort to bring them down, if possible.
Give me your take, your definition of the mind parasite. I'd like to get your view on that.
Okay. Well, if I can, I just want to talk a little bit about regular parasites and then
sure.
Build from there to give it a little bit more of a rational basis for people that might be skeptical.
And these aren't the regular ones that we get with insecticide. This is something else we're talking
exactly,
about.
Exactly. But let's just talk about the regular ones for a minute, because people often underestimate them. Now, in nature, we have three of the most classic relationships are parasitism, predation, and symbiosis. These are relationships of energetic transaction. Well, actually, parasitism seems to be the most common, or at least parasites outnumber all other types of species 3 or 4 to 1. There are more parasites than any other type of organism on the planet. All species have parasites. And many of those parasites themselves have parasites, just like the mosquito is a parasite and it carries malaria, another parasite. Sometimes the second parasites even have parasites. And so as human beings, we have many. AIDS is a parasite, tuberculosis. And parasites have an ability to take over their hosts and to even travel through several different animals to complete their life cycle. You can read about some of these amazing biological parasites in Parasite Rex by Carl Zimmer. And one of the things that biologists talk about in relationship to parasites and evolution is what they call the Red Queen Hypothesis. Now, this comes out of Alice in Wonderland. There's a moment in Alice in Wonderland where Alice is traveling with the Red Queen, and they start running faster and faster, but she notices that they're not getting anywhere. And the Red Queen tells Alice, "Now here you see, it takes all the running you can do to keep in the same place." Well, this is what biologists are telling us now about the coevolution of parasites and host species. Because parasites outnumber us, and because they evolve so quickly, and because they are so much cleverer than people realize, that other species need to constantly evolve just to maintain, just to tread water. In fact, some biologists at Oxford, and this is gaining a lot of credence now in the biological world, believe that sexual reproduction, as compared to asexual reproduction,
right,
sexual differentiation that's so much a part of, you know, our whole world, came out directly as a way to compete with parasites. The only way to keep up with the parasites and the genetic adaptations that they were constantly doing to become more effective was to create sexual differentiation, which through greater genetic novelty gave us a chance to keep up in that evolutionary war with the parasites.
To keep up or fight back?
Really, keep up is all we've been able to do. We are the first species that really has an ability to recognize what's going on with parasites and to do something about it. Now, another aspect of this is that we are capable, as human beings, of missing an entire dimension of life. Now, this was the case with the whole microbiological world. Until the year 1674, nobody, no culture, as far as I know, had a clue about the microbiological world until a Danish shopkeeper, his name was, I'm not sure if I could pronounce it, but it was Leeuwenhoek. And he invented the first microscope, and in 1674 he saw the first microbiological organism, a protozoa, which is probably a giant in the microbiological world. If you were to tell somebody in 1673, hey, did you know that you're not a single being, but you're a colony of 100 trillion animals, they would have you burn at the stake.
Yeah, they wouldn't believe you.
Thing you could possibly think of saying. They had no idea about it. In those days, surgeons washed their hands after surgery, but not before. So then when we discovered that, hey, there's not just all these things down there, we're actually made of them, and there's a fantastic variety of species. And of course, we would find the same classic relationships of energetic transaction, parasites, predators, and symbionts. And so the case that I'm making is that there are energetic organisms. Now, we are the only culture that does not recognize them. The only culture that does not recognize energetic organisms is scientism, fundamentalist materialism. They're recognized in Christianity. They talk about the incubi and the succubi.
Right.
In China, they talked about the kuei. And so many of their customs in daily life, these were like disincarnate spirits. In their medicine, for example, the 361 points of the 14 main meridians of acupuncture, 17 of those points have the word kuei as part of their main or secondary names, as points where these entities could feed or attack us energetically. And Western science can't explain how acupuncture works, but it does admit that it does work. It's just that right now we have a blind spot about ourselves as energetic beings and about energetic organisms, though every other culture recognizes them. So that's what I'm talking about. I'm saying that there are the mind parasites or energetic organisms, and like other life forms, many of them are parasites, but there's many, many different species.
Why are they the way they are, Jonathan?
Well, they're the way they are because everything has to feed off of an energy source. You do, I do, plants do. Everything has an energy source. So for
it's survival, right?
The host, exactly. So they're going to look for the richest deposit of energy they can find. So blood is a popular one, right? Mosquitoes will go after mm-hmm. that. It's a rich source of energy. Well, what's the richest source of energy on this entire planet? Well, it's obviously human energy, human psychic energy, human sexual chi. That's what's dominating the whole planet right now. When you look about your studio, everything there is the result of human energy.
Let's talk a little bit more about Jonathan when we come back. And also, you're going to bring in, at least for a half hour, another guest. His name is Alex Gray. We'll tell you about that in a moment on Coast to Coast AM and why Alex Gray is coming here. Well, here we are in August, but you know what? Pretty soon it'll be the holiday season. If you're looking for some interesting gifts, pretty inexpensive gifts, there's the Coast to Coast gift shop. You can find that by going to the coasttocoastam.com website. There's a link there at the bottom of the homepage. There's also a link there under the banner section on the left-hand side of the homepage screen. You can get anything you want there, the Coast to Coast. Well, almost anything, I guess. But go take a look. Some new items, T-shirts, hats, and just have some fun. We'll be back in a moment with our special guest, Jonathan Zapp, and his guest, Alex Gray, in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast with our special guest tonight, Jonathan Zapp. And Jonathan, I'm going to read the intro to Alex Gray, and then I'll let you explain a little bit more about Alex, okay?
Sure.
Alex Gray went to the Columbus College of Art and Design for 2 years. Later, he attended the Boston Museum School for 1 year. During this period, he had a series of induced mystical experiences that transformed his agnostic existentialism to a radical transcendentalism. Alex then spent 5 years at Harvard Medical School working in the anatomy department. He also worked at Harvard's Department of Mind-Body Medicine, conducting a series of scientific experiments with others to investigate subtle healing energies. Now, with that, Jonathan, tell us a little bit more about Alex.
Well, Alex is a visionary genius, and he has the technical skills of a Renaissance master, but the content of his images, I can only compare in importance, certainly in the effect of my life, to William Blake or Michelangelo, because he pulls back the veil on an unseen world that we all sense, but can only see in flickering moments, and he shows it to us with a kind of X-ray crystalline vision that is absolutely life-changing, and a lot of people have expressed similar sentiments about him.
All right, with that, let's bring in Alex Gray. Hi, Alex. How are you?
Hey, George. Jonathan, thanks for having me on tonight.
My pleasure. Tell us a little bit about this change of these series of mystical experiences. And what happened to you?
Well, basically, my professor introduced me to LSD, and I had never taken any back in 1975. It happened to be on the very same evening that I met my wife, Allison. We've been together ever since. But those two events were a turning point in my life. I had been pretty much of a nihilistic or existentialist kind of agnostic character, and my art was reflecting that struggle of a world without spirit, and I sort of called out to, if there was such a thing as God or spirit, I'd need it now. And within 24 hours, my professor had sort of just offered me this drink with the LSD in it, which he'd warned me about, and I met my wife. And so within 24 hours, I felt like my prayer was kind of answered, because the LSD gave me a mystical experience where I felt I had entered into a luminous realm that I had no idea about previous. And it was a world of light that I felt was extremely spiritual. And so since that time, my wife and I would continue to take these sacramental sort of sojourns with the LSD, and at some of those times we had some remarkable visions that really changed both of our artwork and gave me a new way, a kind of transfigured way to approach the human body and the sort of atmosphere surrounding the body that clairvoyants have talked about for millennia.
Alex, you'll have some people who say, how can you advocate some of these drugs, these psychedelic drugs? And I'm sure throughout your history that question has come up. How do you answer that?
Well, I think that I'm not so much of an advocate as simply I'm telling you what happened to me.
To you.
And I think that for some people who are more borderline personality, it's been shown that these powerful psychedelics can catalyze a pre-existing sort of pre-psychotic kind of state. And so they can destabilize people who are already somewhat mentally unstable. So not good and should be avoided by them. But for people with normal I don't know what a normal mind is.
What is normal anymore, Alex?
But who are fairly stable individuals, these substances have had a long history with human culture. And there's still many indigenous and shamanic sort of religious uses of these kinds of sacraments, the psychedelics. And I think that they've been a demonized kind of method of reaching toward the Godhead. And it's too bad. I think that there's great power there. And however, we know that the West has a troubled relationship with these kinds of things. You know, Adam
sure.
and Eve. Adam and Eve's basically the story of a drug bust, I guess. You know?
Well, we know shamans have used ayahuasca. They've used the LSD. They've used all kinds of other drugs in order to induce, in order to travel, let their minds travel throughout the universe, basically doing things that they couldn't do in a normal state. What did it do for you? I mean, what were you able to do to accomplish?
Well, for one thing, the psychedelic state convinces you that there is a visionary world. If you hadn't, had your fill of it before, just through your own dreams and things, and if you don't remember your dreams, this is a luminous world that is inhabited by various kinds of beings, and you're really not sure whether they're simply projections of your own imagination or whether you're actually perceiving a realm that where these beings are inhabitants. And that's this sort of problem. Are the angels out there, or are they in there? You know, and they're kind of both. That's what it seems like.
Jonah, why do we need the release of the drugs to alter the mind? Why can't it be done without it?
Oh, it can be done without it. Oh, absolutely. And the spiritual practices that the yogis and shamans have done, just drumming can get you there. And certainly the meditation practices of the Tibetan Buddhists, they have relationships with beings that are outside of sort of the material world. They're in this luminous visionary realm, and we do spiritual practice to get in contact with them. It's what mantras are all about.
What have you found in this other realm, Alex, that is out there? You are right. In some cases, it has been surrounded with a shroud of being demonic and evil. Yet I think evil obviously exists, not only on this planet in human beings, but I'm sure it exists in the other realm as well. Did you ever come across that? Did you ever have to travel through that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's you're most likely any kind of psychedelic traveler, a psychonaut, will have experienced both heaven and hell. And so your own greatest fears are projected there on your screen for you to confront as well. And you may feel that you've died. You may feel that you've left your body. You may feel that you've visited a realm of torment and that is sort of inescapable, and yet you're also in these visionary realms able to go to the some of the higher heaven realms. And so that's why your guidance from the set and setting and the loving support of those around you is extremely important.
This is Jonathan breaking in. I'm wondering, Alex, if you could give us an example of one of these journeys, and of course the example that I'd like to hear are the circumstances that led to the painting your masterwork, Demons and Deities Drinking from the Milky Pool, an image that the viewers can see linked up on the Coast to Coast website right now.
Thanks, Jonathan. Well, the LSD session that brought about that painting was with a group of people. There might have been 15 to 20 people, and they were in our loft in Boston. This was back in the 70s, and we had all determined to take LSD. These were, a lot of these people were strangers to me, but we were hosting a group that was led by an associate of Leary's. And at any rate, I thought that they were all mature folks, but after the drugs started to take effect, just it seemed like chaos kind of broke loose. One person was walking around vomiting into a bucket, another person was laughing hysterically, another person was crying, and just somebody was taking their clothes off, other people, and it just seemed like, you know, crazy. And I was lying there, having taken a double dose and assuming that we were going to all be taken care of. And in this kind of melee, I saw above us, it seemed like a swooping numbers of these forms that seemed like both deities and demons. And I saw that there was this, what looked like a vibratory sort of milky pool of kind of electric milk, and all of us were at the periphery of this sort of pool of milk, and it was being drawn through us, and this was sort of like the pool of life energy, and it was being drawn through us as through all the activities that we did, and this was providing a feast for these other beings that were hovering above us and sort of like dining on the energy that we were exuding. And it was a very strange thing to see ourselves in a kind of energetic food chain that these beings, in fact, had organized us all as a feast for themselves.
Is this what you would call the parasites, Jonathan?
Yeah, I think so. I think what Alex perceived, and there's a slightly more full description on the website, a document called Alex and the Mind Parasites, is I think he saw the top of the food chain. And we in our ordinary state of consciousness, we think that we're the top of the food chain, and I think that's a delusion that's very convenient to those that are actually on top of the food chain. But I'm wondering, Alex, if the chaotic behavior you saw among the people in the party, did you feel that did the parasitic deities, I think there are at least two of them in the painting, do you think that they were somehow influencing that in some way?
Well, that's a good question, because at one point I did feel like this entire thing had been orchestrated by these beings, that are coming together, in fact, was not an accident or anything. It was kind of orchestrated. And gosh, it's really, really difficult to say, you know, when we feel influenced to do certain things or intuitively guided to do certain things. You know, many of the times we seek guidance from a higher realm, and I think that in the same way that one can be vulnerable to the influence of beings from a lower realm.
What do you think they were after, Alex? What did they want?
Well, I think that it was basically our energy, and the at least these particular beings seem to be delighted by a kind of orgiastic emanation that was from this particular crowd. But I think that there are, I suppose, mind parasites that I've tried to depict in other paintings, like the self-hatred painting or the despair painting. We can almost feel them like attachments to our energy body, and that tend to drain us and deplete us. And whether we can just use that symbolically as a kind of metaphor that's potent and might suggest a way to at least deal with them. I remember specifically at one time being on one of the most harrowing LSD adventures I ever had, and I felt like I was kind of a flapper in the wheel of fortune, you know, and that every realm of sort of being and dimension was one of these little slots that the flapper was like open to. And at one such, you know, dimension that was flying by, I saw this really strange insect-like creature kind of lunge out at me. And because after I'd come back from this trip, and for days afterward, I was really feeling out of sorts and very, very energetically drained. And I realized in my memory about this trip that this thing had jumped out and was probably still embedded in my aura. So I did a whole kind of cleansing to, you know, draw all the energy back into the heart, and then to, in a sense, expand it out from the heart to banish this being.
Did it work? Were you able to do that?
It did. It really did. And, you know, you just banish them back to where they came from. And, my gosh, it, you know, sometimes things like that can really help.
And I think one of the things that people can take from what you've described, and they should certainly take seriously what you said about the psychonaut experiencing heaven and hell, is that these medicines are a sword that cuts both ways. It's like Sophocles said, no great gift enters the human sphere without an equally diabolical price to be paid for it. And so in addition to the visions that medicines can open, and they've been used by cultures throughout human history, you become incredibly vulnerable. You become your psychic immune system is thrown open, and you become far more vulnerable to attacks that some people indeed do not really survive. And if they have underlying weaknesses in their personality, or have approached with less than the very serious intent that you obviously had, they can be destroyed by the experiences.
Well, I got to tell you, Alex, your artwork is fascinating to look at, and you could obviously tell that your mind has gone deeper than most artists to do what you do.
Well, that's very kind of you, George, and I appreciate the forum that you have given America for discussing alternative ways of looking at reality.
Okay. That's very good. That's Alex Gray. By the way, his website is alexgray, GREY.com, and he's got a book called Sacred Mirrors, The Visionary Art of Alex Gray. It is fascinating work. Jonathan, how is he looked at, and we're coming up to the break, so very quickly, how is he looked at by other artists? I mean, what do they think of him?
Well, I think some will have certain jealous attitudes and that type of thing. I think some recognize him for the genius that he is. But most artists are in the place where Alex was before he went on these journeys. They're postmodern nihilists. And so for them, his artwork is a little bit too challenging for some of them, and they might not recognize it for the value that it really has.
That is a fascinating story. We'll be back with Jonathan Zapp as we talk about energy sappers. We'll get into a little bit more about some of the work of my aunt as well, right here on Coast to Coast AM.